This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. You're listening to Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
It's all about living your best life.
On Dubai Eye 103.8.
Hi, I'm Helen Farmer. Fantastic to have you with us for the Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast and a real health focus on today's show. We were in conversation with the founder of Mind Valley. It is the University of Life, an online platform with more than 60 million subscribers and some celebrity experts sharing their advice on everything from sleep to energy, meditation and a real bit focusing on your goals. And it was the founder and author Vishen Lakhiani who was on hand to talk about his vision for the future of work-life balance, the changes he would like to make if he could wave a magic wand and be in charge of the world. Plus, why meditation might just change more for you than just your stress levels. We were joined live in the studio by Dr. Paul McNamara. He's an orthopaedic surgeon at King's College Hospital, talking about the inevitability of us getting a bit, well, achy as we get older, but what we can do to keep our joints, especially hips and knees, in better condition as we age. And he was on hand to take your questions too on everything from pain post-pregnancy to what you can do if you are going through the menopause to control your symptoms. Dr. Thiriya, clinical psychologist, was on hand helping us create some boundaries if you've got a friend who is always whinging, asking you for free therapy, or perhaps you're the one doing the emotional dumping. She had some great advice for you. And talking antimicrobial resistance. I know it sounds very doctly. Basically, what we're talking about is when the antibiotics stop working because you've been taking too many. A consultant was on hand to explain the questions we should be asking our doctors and ultimately why correct diagnosis is the way forward for a healthier society.
Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Great to have you with us. And we love to chat about work-life balance on the show, what it is, how to get it, does it exist? One person who's also passionate about the subject is Vishen Lakhiani. He is an entrepreneur, an author, a motivational speaker. He is here in the UAE in Sharjah for the Entrepreneurship Festival. He's also the founder and CEO of Mind Valley, which has more than 60 million subscribers and has had the likes of Matthew McConaughey on the platform. Here he is talking about exactly what it is.
Mind Valley is the world's biggest life learning platform. And what we mean by life learning is really giving people the skills to really, really crush it at life itself. And life is about your health. It's about your relationships. It's about your mind, your soul. It's about your career, your entrepreneurial venture. It's about looking at life holistically and succeeding in all the dimensions. And what we do is we give people the education that traditional schooling neglects. So we function almost as an online university. And what I mean by that is that not only do we have classes, but we have a digital campus where our students are connected together in a private social network, interfacing with each other online, but also connecting with each other in meetups, both virtual and real world, all across the planet.
Particularly pertinent given the last 18 months or so, I'm sure, where meetings such as this have really kind of come into their own. Do you have a typical, do you call them students? Do you have a typical client or user or participant?
Yeah, most of the most common job title among our users are startup founder, entrepreneur, CEO and coach. So it's a very highly educated, a very successful group of people. And you know, it's one of those chicken and the egg things. Are they successful because they are so invested in their personal growth? Or are they into personal growth because they are so successful? We don't really know, but it tends to be a really remarkable group of people that we attract as members. And so, you know, one of the advantages of joining Mind Valley is that you have this incredible network that's open to you and accessible to you.
Can I ask which particular classes or courses, topics even, have been really resonating with people of late? What are people really paying attention to at the moment, Vishen?
Well, I'm logging into, I'm opening up my Mind Valley platform right now.
Oh, we're going to get some real-time data.
Yeah, what's hot right now? So it changes month to month. Right now, top five programs in the UAE. The first program is on releasing belief blocks related to money, right? So many people, it's called unlimited abundance. So many people grow up with drama or negative beliefs around wealth and money. And this program is really about releasing these beliefs. The second program is basically on self-esteem. It's using a modality called RTT, which is Rapid Transformational Hypnotherapy. RTT Hypnotherapy, which is Rapid Transformational Hypnotherapy. And it's about removing self-esteem blocks. The third program is actually on accessing altered states for intuition. It's called Silva, the Silva Method. The fifth program is on Qigong. And these are some of the things.
Far-reaching in terms of topics.
Yeah, it's very far-reaching. It seems that in the UAE, people are really into these spiritual programs, the spiritual and mindset programs.
And what about internationally? How many people are in that network? And what's the big draw, do you
think? So we have 20 million followers across all social media channels. But in terms of students, so we just launched something called Mind Valley Membership. And this is a membership where everything is open to you. And this is when you're on a private social network. So our goal is to get to 1 million students. And we are right now at 71,000.
Vishen Lakhiani, the founder of Mind Valley, dubbed as the University of Life, clearly very popular here in the UAE and around the world.
Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
We are talking health this afternoon, and Vishen Lakhiani is the founder of Mind Valley. It's been dubbed the University of Life. He is a techpreneur described as a bit of a disruptor who's managed to grow this platform to reach and help millions around the world. So when did he have that awakening, realize the importance of mental health and overall well-being, especially in the workplace?
I got into meditation very early. I was in Silicon Valley at the time the dot-com bubble burst. It was such a stressful place to be at that point. People were losing their jobs, and even the jobs that you did get were really awful. There were just so many people unemployed, and I was going through a really hard time with my mental health. And that's when I on the verge of a breakdown, I took a class on meditation. And I was surprised because, you know, I would think that the class would help me with just mental health. It would help me with self-esteem. It would help me overcome anxieties or sadness. But it had another effect. It allowed me to just really, really succeed at my workplace. I ended up getting promoted three times in a span of 4 months. At the age of 26, I became vice president of sales. And what was really going on there is that I was learning how to use my mind in different ways. Now, that program was called the Silva Method, and it became the first Mind Valley program. Today, so that was 20 years ago. Today, that program is still one of our best-selling programs. We have updated it for 2020. And so that's how I got really into this field. And because my background is in electrical engineering and computer science, I decided to build a platform to deliver this to as many people as I could.
Can I ask about the science of meditation? What does the data and research say about why this can be so effective? As you're saying, in terms of practical applications in the workplace, but also at a time where mental health has never been in such crisis.
Yeah, well, doctors are now saying that almost 50% of all illnesses are caused by stress, some degree of stress, right? Now, stress isn't just overwork. Stress could come from trauma. Stress could come from sadness. Stress could come from depression. But it's basically our emotional states deeply influence our body. And meditation has been proven as a really effective way to put people in the right states to be able to allow the body to naturally heal itself. But you can also accelerate that healing by going beyond just passive meditation into what in Mind Valley we call active meditation. And active meditation is where you're applying concepts like imagery therapy to visualize disease disappearing, to visualize healthy outcomes. So we just licensed the foremost imagery therapy program in the world, which is the Silva Method. So it's now exclusively on Mind Valley. You know, there's some stunning data. Dr. Ocal Simonton of the Simonton Cancer Research Institute did studies on the Silva Method's form of imagery therapy. And he found that it was able to increase the lifespan of terminally ill cancer patients who were given 12 months to live. It was able to increase the lifespan to about 24.4 months. But not only that, but a significant number of these patients, I'm going to give you the exact data in a moment. I'm actually talking about it here in Sharjah. I'm teaching. So on stage today, I'm going to be talking about imagery therapy. But what happened is that, this is the really fascinating bit. Let me just pull up the numbers so I have an accurate number here. Simonton found that the study was on 159 patients with incurable cancer. And after applying imagery therapy, they found that 4 years later, 63 were alive, 14 showed no signs of cancer, 12 had cancer regressing, 17 were stable, and the average survival time of the group had gone up to 24.4 months. So that's pretty, those are some pretty impressive numbers. So that modality is now one of the many modalities that we teach on Mindvalley. And it's really about teaching people how to harness the power of their mind, not just to keep away stress, but to go beyond that, to actually accelerate healing, to increase your longevity, and to improve your performance in all areas of life, from your relationships to your career and your work.
So do you meditate? What has it done for you? How did it change your life? Or does it leave you a bit cold? We're speaking to Vishen Lakhiani, who's the founder of Mindvalley, and he's got some ideas to achieve work-life balance. And I have to say, spoiler alert, I totally agree with him.
Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Talking health, well-being this hour, and Vishen Lakhiani is the founder of Mindvalley. It's got 60 million subscribers who use it, network, for a whole range of interests and topics, from meditation to energy healing to sleep as well. And he meditates regularly, says it's really changed his life, not just his stress levels, but also productivity in his professional life. So I asked him, how do you get started, especially when you think you have no time for it?
The majority of people today in the world, the majority of working professionals have tried meditation. Not all of them stick to it, but the majority of working professionals have tried meditation. Look, we mistakenly associate meditation with the religious traditions of India and China and the Far East. These are what you call hermetic meditation. They involve long hours of sitting in silence. But meditation is much beyond that. When you practice gratitude, that is a form of meditation. I prefer to use the word transcendent practice. A transcendent practice is any practice that is about going within yourself, right? So practicing gratitude, closing your eyes and visualizing your future, that's a transcendent practice. Closing your eyes and thinking about someone you truly love and radiating love to the world, that's a form of transcendent practice. All of these are in essence meditation. When you practice yoga and you close your eyes on the yoga mat, you use these practices to actually solve problems. For example, today in the Sharjah Entrepreneurship Festival, I'm teaching how to apply active meditation as applied to healing using imagery therapy. But you could just as well apply it to visualizing your goals. You can apply it to increasing your sense of loving kindness. Now, I invented a form of meditation called the six-phase meditation. And the six-phase is basically a series of six transcendent practices layered upon one another that are designed to accelerate the way you show up in the world, to not just reduce stress and anxiety, but to actually unleash incredible degrees of focus, flow, positivity, and feelings of goodwill, luck, and self-esteem when you do it together. And it only takes 15 minutes.
I think for so many people, especially over the course, as I said, of the pandemic, people have just been trying to get by. It's been a case of trying to find a job, trying to hold on to a job, dealing with distance learning for a time with our children at home. It's been trying to look after elderly relatives or unwell relatives in other parts of the world. And now that we're starting to come out of it and some kind of normality is resuming when it comes to being back in the workplace, perhaps do have a bit more opportunity to reflect on this time and think, actually, what changes do I want to make moving forward? What have I actually enjoyed in terms of this last 18 months? And what do I want to, you know, hold on to, whether that is an element of working from home or more humanity in the workplace and understanding what everyone is kind of been going through. What do you think some of the kind of the far reaching effects of the pandemic could be on the workforce?
Overall, across the world, we're going to see increases in anxiety, in fear, in anxiety, fear, stress. But at the same time, I believe this is only temporary. I think the human species is gonna reorient. What's happening is there's a lot of anxiety and fear, and a lot of it is completely unnecessary and made up. If you look at what's happening in many countries in the world, there's a fear against vaccines and vaccine mandates. But this is it's a real fear, but it is an irrational fear. It's more because of misinformation that's being spread on the internet. I believe there is nothing to fear about the vaccine. So today I'd say it's not so much the fear of COVID. Pfizer has just now announced pills that you can take that will severely limit the odds of ending up in hospital. It is this fear that doesn't exist regarding mandates and vaccines. The world is going to go back to normal. The human race is going to be okay. The other thing that's happening, though, is that the pandemic took away one of the most important parts about being human, and that's really people coming together. Social connection is the only thing that correlates to happiness, according to a Harvard study by Ed Diener. They found a 0.7 correlation between strength of your social connection and happiness. And to many people, their social connection came from their workmates. It came from going to school. And all of a sudden, when colleges and schools are shut down, when offices are shut down, people lose that connection. Again, this is temporary, but this is one of the biggest things that leads to a dip in people's levels of happiness. Now, we also know that social connection has a huge correlation with health. In the Blue Zone studies, it was community that was one of the things that led to people living longer lives. And so the taking away of social connection is another reason why there's so much stress and unhappiness in the world today, furthering sadness, depression, and other aspects of bad mental health. But again, this is just temporary. Now, I believe the world is going to be better off than before because two things are going to happen. The first thing is this pandemic is going to get over. Not everybody has to get vaccinated because new medicines are going to be emerging. I have great trust in our scientists who are working to help us overcome this. We've been through pandemics before, but as a result of this pandemic, two positive changes are going to happen. One is because we have been prevented from coming together for so long, I believe the world is going to go into a 1920s style period of
we have the roaring 2020s.
Right, exactly. We're going to go back to the roaring 2020s.
Let's go full Gatsby.
We're going to go full Gatsby. So that's going to happen. And the second thing that's going to happen is the work from home revolution. Working from home is, people are finding that you're more productive in many cases. And while you no longer may meet your colleagues around the water cooler, you will meet them in real life, in restaurants, in bars. But working from home allows people to really cater for their well-being. If you feel down, it's perfectly okay to meditate. If you feel tired, it's perfectly okay to take a nap without anyone judging you. And I believe that most people are responsible. I don't think employers have to fear about people not putting in the hours. I think that's an irrational fear. I think we have to trust people. And I think working from home is going to allow people to really, really take care of themselves. And I think we're going to come off 1 year from now much healthier as a species, much more connected as a species, and in much better mental health.
Shen, I hope you're right. I really do. Now, as you said, you're here for the Sharjah Entrepreneurship Festival. Many people here in the UAE, it's a real, fertile ground for new businesses, incredible ideas, and great support, obviously, in terms of incubating those. But can I ask, in your experience, and you've written, about this extensively, what makes a good entrepreneur in terms of mindset or ambition? What does it take to make it work?
What makes a good entrepreneur is very similar to what makes a good leader. The ability to mobilize a group of people around a vision. And I think it really is that. Because if you can mobilize a group of people around a vision, pretty much anything else, you will find people who can solve for you. A good entrepreneur doesn't have to be a good salesman, but they have to be able to find good salesmen. A good entrepreneur doesn't have to be a good inventor, but they have to be able to find a good inventor. So it's really the number one thing is mobilizing people around a vision. And if you can do that, I believe that is the single thing that is going to make you a great entrepreneur.
We've seen what people are calling the great resignation. So many people, young people in particular, quitting their jobs because they want to protect their mental health. So I'm curious to get your take on who do you think is at fault for, you know, what many people are calling something of a crisis? Is it the bosses? Is it the system? Is it a different generation? What would you say?
It's absolutely the system. The human species is brainwashed to move towards this outdated idea called GDP. It's a post-World War II concept that is designed to measure the efficacy of a country, but actually it's completely pointless and senseless. It is causing us to be an overworked species, consuming more than we need, polluting more than we need, and continuously running around a hamster wheel, working an insane amount of hours to afford stuff we do not need. Start measuring the success of a country based on opportunities. Does everyone have an opportunity to get an education? Does everybody have an opportunity for better health care? Does everyone have an opportunity for mental health services, for happiness, for human connection? We need to measure the concept of a country as, is it giving opportunity for all? On that, America fails big time. And the second thing we got to do is we need to legislate decent working hours, which I believe should be no more than 30 hours a week. Companies should enforce a four-day work week. In fact, I would say it should be a three-day work week. We should be enforcing a three-day work week and 4 days off for people to pursue being human. We do not need to be working 5 days a week. Think about what this would do for families. Think about what this would do for society as a whole. And already studies in which people have moved to a four-day work week, they are finding that there is no drop in employee output.
But I saw that in Japan with Microsoft, incredible results coming out of that trial.
Exactly. But it becomes impossible for companies like ours to move in that direction because of competitive pressure. But if it was legislated, we could all do it.
I think also everyone I speak to, you know, over the weekend is like, Dubai is booming, you know, traffic is back. But there seems to be a real fetishization really around being busy. And people equaling being busy with being in demand and being successful, which I think is a big problem, to be honest. Right. How do you think we can shift our mindset around that?
We need to adopt universal basic income. Universal basic income is important because universal basic income, it levels the playing field. Secondly, a four-day work week and mandating no more than 35 hours. Employees should not have to work more than 35 hours. This gives people time for family, time to truly live life, time to pursue artistic pursuits, time to be human. We're taking the humanness out of life by focusing on concepts like GDP.
Vishen Lakhiani there, the founder of Mind Valley. He is in favour of a four-day work week. It is happening in some companies. Should this be the norm? Are you an employee who agrees, an employer who thinks it's completely impossible?
Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
We're talking well-being now. Vishen Lakhiani is the founder of Mind Valley. It's been dubbed the University of Life, 60 million subscribers worldwide. And he's got some ideas, some dreams for four-day work week for everyone. So I needed to get his advice, really. Well, so much of us spending so much time at work, what happens if you don't love your job? How should you make that decision to leave?
I think if you don't love what you do, I think you got to start making your exit plan. That's not loving what you do, what you spend 70% of your waking hours for, is really going to have a massive toll on your self-esteem, on your mental health, on your health.
Relationships.
It's just not worth it. Yeah, everything. And you can't really be good at something you don't enjoy doing, can you?
So how do you make the change without, because, you know, everyone's living with pressure, you know, especially look at where you live is, you know, it's tied to having a visa. So it's a luxury for some people to say, oh, I'd love to quit my job, but I know I've got a family to support financially and I cannot be in a certain country or circumstance without having that paid for role.
Yeah, that's true, right? That's true. What I think people have to do. So I was in that situation once, and what I did was I was obligated to work 5 days a week. That gave me the weekends, and I spent the weekends building up a small business, doing what I love doing, which in this case ended up becoming Mind Valley. So Mind Valley started as a side project, as a side hobby on the weekend. So that's one thing that you could do. I don't recommend quitting your job outright. A study published in the book Breakthrough Company showed that you are 30% more likely to succeed as an entrepreneur if you start your idea as a side hustle and you hold on to your current job. If you quit your current job cold turkey and you suddenly have finances cut off, that's going to give you a lot of stress and anxiety, and it's not going to be worth it. You could start a side hustle while maintaining your current job. And the good thing about today's world is that it's so easy for anybody to create a side hustle. Whether you're a social media expert or a writer, there are platforms you can go to where you can get side gigs. If you really enjoy those fields, start by getting a side gig, build up your name, your repertoire, your name, your connection. Maybe use that as a way to pivot out of the job that you don't enjoy.
Vishen, can I ask for anyone listening in that younger generation or perhaps parents of that, what are some of the questions you can ask them or yourself to get yourself on the right track from the outset, rather than feeling societal or parental cultural pressures to work in a certain field? How can you have the confidence to pursue your passion and ultimately maybe find what that is if you haven't got a clue?
I don't think everybody has one passion. I think you identify your passion by trying lots of different things, right? That's what I did. I tried programming. I tried graphic design. I tried website building. I tried teaching meditation before I found my passion. I think you have to take a stab at many different things. I think being a generalist and trying out many different things is a great way to find that one thing that really is your gift.
I hope we're going to be moving more into that in the future. And, you know, we look at gig economy and, as you say, side hustles, rather than this idea of, you know, you go to university at 18 to be an accountant and you're an accountant until you die, because so few people are actually living that way now. And in part, you know, to your millions of subscribers because of Mindvalley. So huge thanks for your time today. For anyone who wants to find out more about you, your books, and of course, Mindvalley, what's the best way to get in touch and read more?
The best way is to go to mindvalley.com, or you can also follow me on Instagram at Vishen.
Thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks.
Really appreciate it. And we'll talk to you very soon. Enjoy the UA. It's great to have you here.
Vishen Lakhiani, the founder of Mindvalley. He's a techpreneur who wants you to start meditating and a 4-day work week. Better work-life balance. He would get my vote. Akio getting in touch saying, love what he said. It will take time. Bosses need to realise that our world is changing and so should the workplace rules.
Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Joining us live in the studio, orthopaedic surgeon, it is Dr. Paul McNamara. He is an orthopaedic surgeon at King's College Hospital and the man who, I don't want to say you're solely responsible for getting me up Kilimanjaro, but I definitely think you played a role, sir. How are you?
Very well, thanks, Helen. And thank you very much for inviting me here.
You are very welcome. I think you're going to be a busy man because your kind of specialty area, knees and hips, and I think many people really struggle and often trying to put those symptoms together, trying to get a treatment plan can be a bit intimidating and it's hard to, you know, you chuck Dr. Google in there and everyone gets a little bit overwhelmed with information. So you're here as a voice of reason this afternoon, taking questions. What's been coming?
Best.
What's been coming into clinic recently? Anything interesting?
Well, yeah, I mean, my general sort of spread of population is through the ages. And common things are common depending on your age. So if you're young, fit and active, you're definitely going to be injuring your knee and your soft tissues. And if you're a little bit older, you're going to be probably doing both. And probably when you're much older, it's definitely going to be the bony, definitely arthritis.
As I said, you were very much a voice of reason for me. I've had dodgy knees since I was about 12, thanks to my mum and my football-playing grandfather. And people have seen my knee x-rays and gone, right, well, we need to get into surgery, or let's do, we'll think about a knee replacement in the next few years. And your approach was much more, let's just, you know, let's try this, let's try that. We'll do some physio, we'll do some injections. And it's been, I don't say it lightly, it has been life-changing, to be honest. But surgeons have a bit of a reputation here in the UAE for loving you getting under the knife. And I just wondered, if we're talking about knees in particular, when is that kind of surgery needed?
Yeah, well, that's an excellent question. That is really the question I get most asked in the clinic. And like all good surgeons, they should avoid surgery. And that sounds sort of counterintuitive, but you should really be doing the simple things first. And you ask the patient just how active they are, and primarily how much pain are they getting with the activity, and maybe even at rest. Are there things that we can avoid surgery, like, for example, physiotherapy, or maybe some injections, or maybe some simple anti-inflammatories like Brufen, or we've got some slightly better ones now that are not so harsh on the stomach. So it's just really a sort of general assessment before we get even to thinking about surgery. Some of the time, we can see a patient and treat the symptoms and the x-rays, and they need to go, you know, they need to have surgery on the first visit. But an awful lot of the time, I'm sending most of my patients away for other therapies.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, that's really good to know.
Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Orthopaedic surgeon Dr. Paul. So going to your messages, and that's exactly what this hour is about. It is your free clinic. You don't need to make an appointment. Just need to pick up your phone. So maybe it's symptoms that aren't adding up, or new symptoms, you're not sure if you need to go to see a specialist or just go to your family doctor, or indeed you need an expert second opinion, this is your chance. Ifty's been in touch saying, I gave birth last year and I've had a really bad knee since. My gynae said it would go away after a few weeks, but it's been more than a year. Any advice, please? Maybe I just need to lose weight. Would love a second opinion. Well, first of all, congratulations on the family growing. And yeah, I think that we cannot underestimate what the body goes through with pregnancy and giving birth, Dr. Paul. But have you had something similar coming into clinic before? Yeah. This change, really?
Yes, many times. I think just generalised body aches, because all the hormones that were trying to get the baby out relax all the other ligaments and structures in and around the body.
Dr. Paul, for those watching on Facebook, he has a model of a knee. Let's have a look. So what happens?
So all the sort of ligaments and that restrain normally a normal knee in pre-pregnancy time then become a bit loose. Mm-hmm. And as a result, they get stretched. And beyond that stretch point, you get a kind of pain. And this is usually actually within the pelvis and often within the back. Also, you've got to remember your routine has changed. So you've probably been picking the baby up in a difficult way. And, mm-hmm. And you're not really focusing on actually bending down properly and getting your joints sorted out. You just want to pick the baby up safely. So I think that this is quite common. It does also depend on how long someone's been breastfeeding for. So obviously, if the relaxed hormones are still in play, then this will obviously have a longer term in with the joints. But if it is probably after a year of giving birth, then probably you want to go and see someone and make an assessment.
And what kind of treatment plan would tend to happen? Is it a case of doing some strengthening, waiting it out, bit of pain management?
Yeah, well, more often than not, you make an assessment. If there's nothing surgical, and as I said, most things aren't surgical, then you would probably send someone for physio and just generalise conditioning and just get them to be a little bit more active and walk more.
And as you say, a bit more mindful about how you're moving around.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. I mean, that's the key to it. If you can keep moving, then it's very important. And especially at this time of year, I think, trying to encourage people when the weather's really good to get out there and just keep active. And the other thing to say is, with the posture as well. Mm-hmm. If you're sitting down for long periods of time just to get the posture sorted out.
It can feel counterintuitive as well if you're having joint pain and knee pain. You just feel like, oh, should I be just putting my feet up and resting? But yeah, as you say, often movement can really get that swelling down and help an awful lot.
I'm a massive fan of that. And I never underestimate the power of walking, and a good fast-paced walking. Even with a baby, you take the buggy out, go on, those lovely rubber mats that we've got here along mm-hmm. the beach or wherever it takes, or around the lakes, just get out there, move. And I think a lot of those joint pains will suddenly disappear.
Hope that helps. 0487155500 is the number to give a call. And my husband has been in touch. Now, just for context, my husband is doing the white collar boxing in mid-December. Mm. And he was sparring last week, came home in agony, and here he is.
I have like a rib injury. I saw my doctor and I did an x-ray, and I don't think there's any cracks, but what would be a good treatment plan to try and make sure that my ribs can heal as quickly as possible? There's no visible bruising, but it's really tender.
Really tender, lots of wincing when coughing and getting in and out of the car and that kind of thing. Is there anything? He's got anti-inflammatory, he's got some big patch things he's got on, but for anyone who's trying to heal up, and speed up that healing process, any advice?
Well, yeah, I mean, basically, you don't want to be doing any more boxing for a bit.
Shh. He really wants to do it.
Well, I think he's probably at least 6 weeks out from that. And, I was just saying that most of the time in the UK, we don't even x-ray these. We just treat people symptomatically. It can be a bit, it can catch you on the breath. We mm-hmm. don't want to make sure that you don't get any shortness of breath and just make people comfortable. And usually within about 3 or 4 weeks, it hasn't fully healed at that stage. You have to be careful of going back too early. You can settle the pain down. And then probably by about 6 weeks, it would have healed. There's nothing really that speeds up bone healing. It can slow it down by, you know, aggravating it and moving it more, but you can't really speed it up.
Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
The doctor is in the house, or in the studio. Dr. Paul McNamara is an orthopaedic surgeon at King's College Hospital. Dr. Paul is sitting here with an array of fake knees in front of him. And Paul has been in touch, Paul, saying, I'm 56, a knee replacement is definitely in my future, but how long do they last now? I think that's a really great question, because traditionally everyone's like, I mean, you can get one, but you'll be lucky to get, you know, 10 years out of it. What is the latest in terms of technology?
Yeah, well, we tell patients now around about 20 to 25 years, and it depends on the level of activity that patients are going to go through. It may even last longer. We don't know, because some of the technology now has only been around, you know, for maybe the last 10 years. But we're telling patients on a sort of conservative estimate around about 20, 25 years. It probably might be even more than that if I'm sort of.
And who would be a good candidate for a knee replacement?
So that's a very good question. I think we have to assess these patients. And first of all, we have to make sure that the pain is sufficient for it to warrant a knee replacement. Because once you haven't new knee put in, you can't really go back. Mm-hmm. And that's why coming back to that, exhausting the conservative therapies is all important before you get to the point of a knee. There are sometimes I see someone on the first time and it's no question about it. Their pain is so bad. And usually pain at night is a good indicator, or pain at rest, or they're usually limited in their walking distance. I mean, let's say that maybe 5 years ago they were going around Dubai more twice, and now they can barely get around half the time.
Okay.
So, you know, you can gauge it on that. And then, so I always say to patients, I treat them patient and their symptoms first before I see the x-ray. The x-ray only really just confirms everything that I had before. And it sometimes can be the case that an x-ray can be really bad, but the symptoms aren't as bad. And then I'll send patients away again. You know, I literally had someone with a completely worn out knee one day, and he was doing Ironman. You know,
so he seemed to be coping all right, fella.
Yeah, exactly. So I send him away. I mean, I don't know if he's had one since, but you know, you're not doing knee replacements for Ironman. You know?
Okay, good to know, Paul. I really hope that helps. And Sofiane's been in touch on 4001, saying thank you for the show as always. You're very welcome. Saying I'm a guy, 38 years old, kind of hyperactive, especially swimming and soccer. 169 kilos, 179 centimeters. Recently had a knee injury, a meniscus tear as per the diagnosis. My issue is that pain comes and goes. What is the best treatment for such an injury? Now, we hear the word meniscus an awful lot, especially around athletes as well. What exactly is a meniscus?
Well, it's essentially the shock absorber of the knee, and it's very good at taking direct load, but it's not so good at sort of twisting stuff. So that's why if you do sports like soccer, where you're planting your foot and twisting, for example, when you're kicking a football, that it will shear some of that meniscus and cause quite intense pain. Now, meniscal tears are actually quite common after about 40 anyway. It's part of the kind of graying process, okay, unfortunately.
Great.
Yeah, so that's what we call a degenerative tear. Okay, now in the past, we would have treated that like a young person's tear and gone in and washed it out and debrided the meniscus. I don't do that anymore, and the evidence, because the evidence just simply isn't there anymore. So I see a lot of very unhappy patients. Maybe, you know, they're in their mid 40s, you know, early 50s, and they've gone for a knee arthroscopy, and 6 months later they've said it really hasn't worked. And I think that's kind of important point to make, because it wastes a lot of time for that patient when they could have been rehabbing in a different way. Because bearing in mind, you have an operation, you've got then got to take 6 weeks, you know, maybe you've got time off work and all that sort of stuff. In the meantime, they could have gone for a good physio and probably advised to lose a little bit of weight, you know, and maybe had an injection in the meantime. So I think the other thing as well is, if they are patients who are about to come for a knee replacement themselves, there is now evidence that that might actually compromise the knee, and you may actually risk getting infected, which is a very serious thing. We try everything we can to try and avoid it. So I would suggest that you need an assessment, first of all, and there are a couple of symptoms that I would look out for with a meniscal tear, what we call mechanical symptoms: catching, locking, and giving way. Okay, and people ask me, what's catching? Well, it's sort of, you can feel it. The knee doesn't really go out straight, but you can get it out straight eventually. It doesn't, same with locking. It's not a lock where it's sort of rigidly held in place forever, but it sort of just catch, and it's not quite right. That's very different to just having straightforward pain within a knee. And those sort of assessment, I'm making that in that kind of middle-aged knee. Okay.
Not that we're saying you're middle-aged, Sofiane. At 38, you are just a spring chicken, she says, at age 39. A great question here from Jamil saying, who is a good candidate for PRP? My doctor's pushing me to have one after a tear.
Okay.
So what is PRP?
I
can see your face. You're like,
yeah. Yeah. Okay, so the PRP is sort of a stem cell. And the idea is that you inject this stuff and it's meant to make the cells that heal within the knee cartilage. I have done a little bit of research about 20 years ago, did a master's, and I tried to grow all these sorts of cells in a lab. It's really difficult. So I think most proper scientists agree that you cannot just inject a certain amount of this sort of fluid and then put it in. Now, that is a very controversial thing to say. I know there'll be a lot of orthopaedic surgeons.
4001 to have your say with Dr. Paul.
But I think mainly through the orthopaedic community. But I'm just not a great believer in PRP generally. And I'm sorry to say that. I know that there'll be a lot of people coming in after me after that. But the evidence isn't there at the moment, in my opinion. It may come on later and we may see it, but I don't think it is there at the moment.
All right, Jubil, there you go. Something to go back to Dr. Withill. It's always good to ask questions of experts and do some good research as well. 4001, if you've got any questions for Dr. Paul, orthopaedic surgeon, joining us live on air. No name on this message saying, I've had back pain for years, but now have pain in my knee. MRI, all negative for rheumatoid arthritis. My friend has told me this is par for the course as part of the menopause. Is she right? You're saying a lot of your patients are in their 50s. What do we know about kind of knee pain in the menopause? Is that something you've come across before?
No, not really. But I think the thing is, it's just general wear and tear, and maybe. And I think that that's a very kind of what we call... I tend to put arthritis in three categories, kind of mild, moderate and severe. The severe ones probably going to end up with a knee replacement eventually. The moderate ones are the really tricky ones. And these are the ones where they get caught in that kind of PRP. And for me, it's just the simple measures at that stage. Losing weight, building up your quadriceps, you know, with good physio, and even going on YouTube. You know, there's some excellent YouTube advice about that if you can't afford a good physio. And basically maybe one or two injections, okay, but in my opinion, PRP. We've got this stuff called hyaluronic acid.
This is what I had before I climbed Kilimanjaro. And can you explain a little bit about what it does? Because I would never do a good job of explaining it adequately.
It's the oil in the joint. Okay, and the reason why I put that in is because there is good evidence that's been backed up for over 20 years now. And it works, I say to patients, around about 50-50. And I tell patients that. In my experience, actually, the more active the patient, the better it lasts. And it doesn't last forever. I mean, you're talking about sometimes it only lasts for about a month, and maybe sometimes up to 6 months. But the idea is that it gives you a window of sort of relatively pain-free opportunity to build up the quadriceps. I think the quadriceps are a little bit, the muscles at the top of the thigh, they're a little bit like the suspension on the car. That if you have a bit of damage within the knee, that will allow, that was kind of, is a good spring really to avoid any pain from sort of cartilage and meniscus. So I think the key things, a good physio and a good physio, you know, I've noticed now there's a difference between just having sort of standard physio and someone who's really actively taking part in doing this.
Really hope that helps.
Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Live in studio is Dr. Paul McNamara, orthopaedic surgeon at King's College Hospital. Love this question from Kanita that's come in saying, is there a workout or activity you would advise against? I once overheard an orthopaedic doctor saying he would never ride a motorcycle. Would you ride a motorcycle?
No. Definitely not.
For joint reasons or for other reasons?
Yeah, for other reasons. I've worked in probably every unit where these people end up, you know, a neck unit, a spinal unit. I mean, obviously trauma, many trauma units. I'm definitely not going anywhere near. I went once for someone's birthday on a 1100 London to Cheltenham. And I'm never doing it again.
There you go.
Leaning in. No.
What about other activities and workouts?
Okay, so... I would say that, you know, the squats are great, you know, up to a point. But there's quite a lot of load going on, especially in the front of the knee. And I think most people, even with good normal knees, say you're a 20-year-old, get a lot of pain at the front of the knee after too many squats. What is too many? Well, if it's the first time and you end up doing 50 on the first day, that's too many. If you're doing them regularly and you've built your muscles up, it's all, again, about this quadriceps build-up, then it probably isn't so much if you do 50. But I tend to say to patients, you know, try and limit them to about once or twice a week. You know, they're quite hard on the knees, I think.
What about burpees? Just so I can tell my trainer that my doctor says no.
Yeah, again, I think probably, my advice is probably about once or twice a week. They are good and they're a very effective form of exercise, and especially in building up the quads. But I don't, they can be quite sore.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I'll forward the podcast on. Message here on 4001 for you, doctor, saying, I'm 57 years old, lately been having problems with my right knee. When I walked too much last Wednesday, walked almost non-stop in Expo, and by the end of the night, I was in severe pain. Haven't had any checkups, I'm past menopause, and would be considered a little bit overweight. I think, I can ask you what your kind of, it's obviously impossible to give a diagnosis over SMS, but for someone who is having issues such as this, is it a case of going to your family doctor first and then being referred to a specialist such as yourself, or could you go direct to you, Dr. Paul?
Yeah, well, she can definitely come direct to me. I 100% without even thinking, I think it's probably going to be some degree of arthritis, depending on how much. It is. It can be, as I said, we do mild, moderate, and severe. If you're getting pain after, and given your age and being slightly overweight, it would be in the moderate, maybe to the severe category. As I said, the surgeons are quite interested in when we're going to do surgery and when we're going to do knee replacements and things. And coming back to that, you want to be having a lot of pain at night, or it's just restricting your walking distance and your activities of daily living. You know, is it difficult to get your shoes on and off?
Affecting that quality of life.
Yes, exactly, yeah.
So I think you need to go along to have a chat with the doctor, get a treatment plan in place. But yeah, as you're saying, those conservative measures before going under the knife is absolutely crucial from the outset. Lastly, before I let you go, can I ask you, as we are all getting older, and we are, in Dubai, it's a younger population. Mm. So, it's not like you're in the UK where you'd be treating people in their 70s, 80s. Mm-hmm. Most of your patients are kind of like 30s to 50s, I would imagine.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, 30s, 60s. Yeah.
So what can we do about kind of making sure our joints, in particular knees and hips in your case, are staying as healthy as possible for as long as possible? And this could be diet, supplementation, exercise. Dr. Paul, if you could, for everyone listening today, to make sure they're staying off the table and end of the knife, what can we all do?
Well, I think the thing is to stay as active as you can, because there is even good evidence that even if your knee is a little bit worn out and the cartilage is a little bit damaged, I mean, just being very active. And walking is massively underestimated, as I said. I mean, a good fast-paced walking with friends, build up those quadriceps, and it's enjoyable as well. So, do things that you enjoy. I mean, these Muay Thai guys, they end up blowing out their knees quite easily with all that kind of kicking and stuff. But, a good fast-paced walking will really do an awful lot for you. And then, of course, there's the things like, keeping the weight off, that would be, and there's all sorts of things online and people can advise.
When you think about kind of optimal BMI, it's just making sure that, you work that calculation out and try and stay within that normal range,
absolutely, yeah, because obviously the more you're putting down through your knees from load, the more it's going to wear out.
Yeah, and I have to say, I went to see a doctor where I had tendonitis in my knee about 10 years ago, and him going, you losing 20 kilos would make, you would improve 90% of your problems. And he was absolutely right.
Yeah, and I think that's absolutely right, and especially in this population here, because obviously the patients are in a population that probably doesn't, most of them don't need knee replacement. So it is just about advice about weight loss and physiotherapy.
Dr. Paul, thank you so much. As I said, you can be found there, orthopaedic surgeon at King's College Hospital. I sincerely hope everyone listening today does not need to go and see you, but if they do, you are the man for the job. You're looking after me and Richard Dean, all the knees of Dubai Eye. You're a superstar. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks so much.
Really appreciate it.
Healthy Habits
on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
It is your Psychology Hour, and we're talking about friendship and maybe taking advantage of that friendship. Imagine you've got the best friend in the world. You love them to bits. You share everything with each other. But there's a problem. You could be treating them like your therapist, emotionally burdening them with your traumatic experiences, your negative energy, or maybe it's the other way around. They could be sharing things that weigh you down emotionally and you've started dreading taking their calls. We're talking about that fine line between friend and therapist with an actual therapist, the clinical psychologist, Dr. Thuraya, joining us from the Human Relations Institute and Clinic. Okay, so we'll put you and your professional training aside, because I feel like everyone is perhaps more emotionally engaged and more emotionally informed about psychological terms than ever before. We, talking about gaslighting in day-to-day conversations. We're perhaps looking on Instagram or reading more about things. And then this turns into kind of, just conversations. And I just wanted to ask you a little bit about what the effect can be if you are that friend who is an involuntary therapist. You're the one that's being, I don't want to say emotionally dumped on all the time, but maybe that is what I'm saying.
I think it could be quite draining. I mean, essentially what you're experiencing is this emotional exhaustion where you feel like you need to be there for that friend and you need to help them, but equally it's weighing you down. It's just really exhausting. So a lot of people that are emotionally dumped on feel a sense of heaviness, and they almost feel like the person's energy, negative energy, ends up being put on them. So essentially it can be quite draining for them.
I think for many people, though, we like to turn to our friends for advice. And sometimes, you know, sometimes it can be weeks or months and we don't actually need to be offloading emotion. And then it could be a difficult period. It could be problems at work. It could be a breakup. It could be, well, all, you know, all manner of things. But when can you start to draw the line if you are the friend that is being offloaded onto? If it's becoming, as you say, a real drain, you're starting to dread the phone calls, you're starting to feel like that friendship is quite one-sided. How do you begin to even broach that subject without it becoming a friendship ender?
Well, I think it's important to be able to set that boundary in a very respectful manner, to say to your friends, you know, I really want to help you and I really want to be there for you and I can see how much this is troubling you. It's just that right now, I don't think I'm in the right mindset or the right space to give you the kind of, you know, space that you need in order for you to be able to feel better from everything that you're experiencing. And maybe if we talk about it a little bit later, if you give me some time to process what you've said. So it's not so much that you're telling the person, oh, I don't want to talk to you right now, or stop telling me all of your problems, but it's more so just acknowledging the fact that you may not necessarily be in the right mindset, or maybe not, you don't necessarily have the time to have the conversation, and you want to honor that to your friend, and you want to honor their story enough that you are sharing that with them.
For me, it's when people ask me for advice and I kind of go, I don't have the emotional or any kind of intelligence to actually help you with this. And I feel like I'm going to do more damage than good than if you're actually looking for constructive advice. I'm not the person you should be coming to. And it's quite hard to phrase that in a way where you're like, I am here for you emotionally, but don't look to me to be answers to all your problems. There are people that can help in a more realistic way.
Well, I really think that nobody should give anybody advice, to be honest.
I mean,
and this is something that we are very
adamant
not doing in therapy, is that we never give advice. And the reason for that is because, you know, there are two downsides to giving advice. Number one is that if you give advice and it goes well, then people start to become dependent on you and always come to you for advice, which can be extremely draining. And number two, if you give people advice and it doesn't go well, guess who they blame? They blame you. So essentially, these are downsides to giving people advice. But more than anything, it's that nobody actually knows and can really say what it's like to be another person. So when you're mm-hmm. trying to give people advice, you're giving it to them from your own perspective, your own experiences, your own mindset, and everything that you've gone through in your life, which is unfair because that may not necessarily be the case for the other person.
Dr. Therese with us this afternoon. If this is resonating, get in touch, 4001. You can, of course, be completely anonymous if you prefer. That's absolutely fine. A message from Shay here, though, saying it should be a two-way street. If you're able to dump all your negative emotions on your friend, they should be able to do the same to you. Otherwise, it's just a one-way friendship.
Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Joining us on Microsoft Teams, Dr. Therese, clinical psychologist at the Human Relations Institute and Clinic. And we're talking about friendship boundaries, especially when it comes to you, well, not necessarily wanting to be their therapist or wanting to give advice, but they keep on coming back. Or perhaps you're the one that's doing the emotional dumping. Dr. Therese, can we talk a little bit about boundaries in friendships? Because, you know, it's a tricky one because friendships evolve. You know, we might meet someone and it becomes a casual acquaintance, and next thing you know, you're spending a lot of time together, and you don't often take a step back and reflect on expectations in terms of communication. And then next thing you know, you're in a situation such as the one we're talking about, and people getting in touch about saying that, you know, they don't want to be the agony aunt of their friend. They don't want to be, you know, the shoulder that they cry on all the time. They want to be a good friend, but this is perhaps a bit too much. When it comes to setting boundaries in life in general, what are some of the questions you need to ask yourself to make sure you are kind of living by your values, I guess, and feel like you're not being taken advantage of?
Well, I think you said the right word, Helen, which is values. I think you first need to recognize what your values are so you can understand what boundaries you want to set in life. So, you know, especially with friendship And like you said, friendships evolve and some get closer, some get more distant. I think it's important to kind of just check with yourself and see what matters to you and what matters to your friends as well. So it's about honoring both sides of the friendship. And I think that's really important when it comes to boundaries, but because boundaries are not just about seeing what is acceptable for you in the way that people treat you, but it's how you accept to treat other people. And those need to be balanced. So essentially, when you don't want people to disrespect you, it also means that you have to be cognizant to not disrespect other people as well. So mm-hmm. It's really about finding that balance between what you would like from people and also honoring what they would like from you.
Oh, it's so tricky because I was about to say no one likes confrontation. That's not true. I don't like confrontation. I'm sure some people actually do quite enjoy it. But when is it time to cut the cord? When is, you know, we think about how emotional, you know, relationship breakups can be, but friendship breakups can be just as traumatic. Mm-hmm. What kind of things do you need to consider when a friendship just stops making sense to you and it becomes something that's a cause for upset and time wasted and drama that you don't want in your life?
Well, I think the first thing that you need to do is reflect on why that's happening, why you feel that the relationship is not really healthy for you at this time. And once you realize that this is something that you could be contributing to and your friend could be contributing to, maybe you want to step in and change the way you behave to see if that alters the way your friend behaves. However, if you start to realize that you're doing everything that you can to maintain a healthy relationship, but your friend is not honoring that and they're not really reciprocating, then this is where you want to start to take some steps back. And then if your friend says anything as a, why are you being distant? This is where you can have that open communication. Say, you know, I've really tried to keep this in a healthy relationship, but at times I feel, and then you start discussing all the nitty gritties and the details. And sometimes the friend might be a little bit more aware and mindful to the things that you want adjusted. And sometimes the friend might get very defensive and might blame you and so on and so forth. And that'll give you more information. And I think it's important to kind of understand that when we're confronting, and I know confronting has such a negative connotation, but in essence, a confrontation is anytime there's a disagreement between two people, and that can happen in a very respectful and diplomatic way. So confrontation doesn't have to be awkward. I think our confrontations only become awkward when we make them awkward.
I make them awkward all the time. We've talked about ghosting in the past, mostly when it comes to those romantic relationships. So, yeah, we obviously shouldn't cut off all contact without any explanation, which is, you know, really disrespectful in all situations, be it professional, personal, romantic, or you know, friendship. But I'm going to come back to your point about, you know, trying to not lay all the blame on them. And this is, again, comes back to romantic relationships. So often be like, you know, they are the bad guy. They wronged me. I'm the innocent party here. I'm the victim. Can that often be the case in friendships as well?
Absolutely. It's definitely anytime you have a relationship in general, be it a friendship, an intimate relationship, or even with your parents, with your siblings. I mean, usually it's easier to be like, oh, you know, this person, this and this person, that, rather than looking at what we are accountable for and what we are responsible for. And that's essentially the difference between emotional dumping and venting, right? Is emotional dumping is when we don't take accountability for our behavior, whereas venting is that we actually take accountability. So this is extremely important when we're looking at how we are evaluating our friendships, because we are responsible for setting our boundaries and we are responsible for making sure that our communication is effective enough for our friends or our partners to truly understand our needs and our wants and our desires. When that's not happening, that's when we need to take a step back and say, okay, these are things that we need to change in order to ensure that this relationship moves in the direction that we want it to. And one of the analogies that I use with my clients is I say, try to imagine a bullseye. So in the center circle, these are your closest friends. These are I call them your ride or die. These are the ones that you know will always be there for you no matter what. These are the ones you have the least amount of boundaries with, but even the ones in the center, you have boundaries with nevertheless. But as you go outside from the inner circle, you should have more and more boundaries. So it's not that you have to get rid of your friends if your relationship is toxic, but you can definitely start to set stricter boundaries with them and maybe move them from the inner circle to the outer circles. Because, you know, as time changes and as time passes, relationships change, people change, and, you know, just the friendship itself changes.
And I think often, and again, with romantic relationships, just because a relationship ends doesn't mean it's unsuccessful. Sometimes we have friends for reasons and seasons, and if they're not working, then it's okay to say goodbye, or as you say, to move them out of that inner circle and change the dynamics, the boundaries. And that's okay. But I think it's to come back to your point about having honest conversations, sometimes difficult, can really be helpful for everyone moving forward. Now, what I would say is that anyone who is finding themselves being emotionally dumped on, used as not just venting, but an ongoing, your shoulder's a bit wet from all the crying that's been happening on it, do feel free to send anyone to Dr. Thuraya's office instead. Professionals are there for a reason. They've had years and years of training, and it might be a bit irresponsible to be offering up some psychological advice if you're not indeed a psychologist. Dr. Thuraya, thank you so much for your time. Really, really appreciate it. And you can find Dr. Thuraya at the Human Relations Institute and Clinic.
Healthy Habits
on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
We are talking health this afternoon, and believe it or not, there is a week for everything. It is World Antimicrobial Awareness Week. Antimicrobial resistance is a significant problem. One, in fact, that the World Health Organization has declared it was one of the top 10 global health threats facing humanity. So this is misuse and overuse of antimicrobials. Basically, one of the main drivers is the development of drug-resistant pathogens. And to explain a little bit more about why we need to be aware of this and perhaps some adjustments we can make is Dr. Zahir Babeka. He is a consultant at infectious disease at the Sheikh Shakabut Medical City. Dr. Zahir, thank you so much for being with us this afternoon. For anyone who is thinking, what is antimicrobial? How can you explain in non-doctorly talk what exactly we're discussing this afternoon?
Right. Thank you very much for having me. Well, basically, an antimicrobial is a medicine that is used to kill bacteria, parasites, fungi, or viruses.
Can you explain a little bit about how we would have come in contact with this in our day-to-day lives and, you know, perhaps explain some of the conditions we might be more familiar with?
Right. So we come in contact with this because we receive antimicrobials for various infections, and this increases our risk for having or developing resistance against these agents. These are very useful medicines that we use on a day-to-day basis, but we have to be careful about using them, and handling them with care is really one of the top priorities, because we don't have many antibiotics that we can use to treat infections, mm-hmm. and there are not many antibiotics that are in development right now.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because, you know, we do tend to throw antibiotics around a bit willy-nilly, especially quite early on in symptoms, without perhaps necessarily finding out if antibiotics are the answer. So when we're talking about antimicrobial resistance, this is when, you know, as you say, the bacteria, the fungi, the viruses, parasites no longer respond to those medicines. And I just wondered, when we think about resistance, is there a marker as such where a body will stop responding? Is there a certain number of treatments or courses of antibiotics, or is it very individual from person to person?
Right. Okay. So antibiotic prescribing at the community level affects us as individuals, because that makes the pool of bacteria and other microorganisms resistant. And if we get infected with them, then we are unlikely to have a simple infection that can be cured by commonly found antibiotics. And therefore, we have to take a collective action to ensure the rational use of antibiotics, so we can have a healthy society.
Basically, we need to be a bit more aware of what we're putting into our body. Otherwise, treatment for seemingly quite straightforward issues might get a little bit more complicated. And why do you think that resistance is increasing in our society, Doctor?
It is increasing because antibiotics are widely available, they are cheap, and because people often walk into a pharmacy and ask for antibiotics without a prescription. And also because sometimes you find parents pushing for their children to have an antibiotic prescription mm-hmm. for simple infections like coughs and colds, which are mostly due to viruses. Now, antibiotics do not kill viruses. Antibiotics kill bacteria. And there are other types of antimicrobials that can kill parasites and fungi. So we have to be careful about using antibiotics. We should only use them when they are indicated, i.e. there is a bacterial infection.
So this is often, it comes back to the doctor. I mean, I'm sure some patients will push for antibiotics and perhaps not take no for an answer, but it, can it come down to, you know, poor diagnostics?
There is very good evidence to say that using rapid diagnostic tests will help rationalize the use of antibiotics. For instance, if someone walks into a clinic with a sore throat, which can be to a virus or a bacteria, they can have a strip put on the back of their tongue, and that will test for the common bacteria that causes sore throats. If that's negative, then there is no need for prescribing any antibiotics.
I've had this myself, gone in, sore throat, and it's been, right, let's do a quick strep test, rule out anything that could be a bit more complicated. Even though traditionally I've had things like tonsillitis, and I know exactly the medication that I need, but it is about making sure you're getting an accurate diagnosis before you start chucking the meds at it. So what do you think we can do then in our day-to-day lives, us the general public, to kind of, become... Yeah, let's say antimicrobial resistance awareness champions. Can you give us some advice?
Yeah, so I think awareness is really the most important thing to have here. Educating the public about the pros and cons of antibiotic use is really important. Using antibiotics to treat blood poisoning is life-saving. However, antibiotics are completely hopeless for treating simple sore throats and coughs and colds, which are mostly due to viruses. So that's quite important. And also, I think it's also important to influence the prescriber behavior. For instance, doctors are human beings. They can be having maybe a false impression that if they do not give a prescription, they will be judged adversely or negatively by their patients. And therefore, we should say it's okay not to give antibiotic if it's not indicated. In fact, most doctors in other parts of the world are happy to admit that most of the antibiotic prescribing is not appropriate. Mm-hmm. So it's not just about education for the patients. It's also about influencing the prescriber behavior. So having guidelines for appropriate use of antibiotics is very important, so doctors can know exactly which antibiotic is the right one to choose for the specific condition that the patient is presenting with. And also for them to learn not to prescribe antibiotics only when there is active infection.
Can I ask, in terms of, we're all very cautious about our health right now, and I wondered, has the pandemic perhaps changed how we react to viruses and bacteria? Are we perhaps a bit quicker to throw meds at it than we were before, or have you seen no difference as a doctor?
No, in fact, the pandemic has highlighted the importance of adhering to best practices in terms of infection prevention and control. The root cause of antimicrobial resistance is inappropriate treatment of infection. So preventing infection is actually quite helpful in combating antimicrobial resistance.
Here's a question for you, sir. If we're thinking we might have antibiotic resistance, what are some of the perhaps telltale signs, and what can we do about it?
So antibiotic resistance does not really manifest itself in any kind of specific symptom or sign, but it has significant adverse consequences on patients' quality of life. For instance, a simple condition that could be treated on an outpatient basis would end up require hospital admission, would probably end up require treatment with several antibiotics with significant side effects. And this will also have a significant impact on the healthcare structure by increasing the cost of treatment.
So thank you for your time today. I would have interrupted you if you'd been a bit too medical for my liking, but you've made it all sound super clear. And I think, as you say, raising awareness, having conversations such as this, not rushing to, get hold of antibiotics, to certainly use old ones. People do not use old medication, and to push doctors into prescribing when it's not medically realistic or accurate. It's so, so important. We all have a bit of a role to play in this. Thank you for your time, Dr. Zahir.
No problem.
You are their consultant of infectious disease at Sheikh Shabit Medical City. And what are you doing at the hospital around this awareness campaign?
So we are celebrating the World Antimicrobial Awareness Week at SSMC. And we have got several activities. We've got a booth in the main hospital reception. We've also got online quizzes for our staff. We've got other activities as well going on at the same time.
Thank you. Is it weird to say Happy World Antimicrobial Awareness Week, or is that something that you're exchanging cards for?
I would say spread awareness about antibiotic resistance, and let's work together to make this planet a better place to live in.
Wise words indeed. Thank you, Doctor. Really appreciate your time this afternoon.
All right. All the best. Thank you.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Join the conversation
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
You can tune into Afternoons with me, Helen Farmer, live on Dubai Eye 103.8, Sunday to Thursday between 2 and 5. Don't forget to rate and subscribe to this podcast. It helps other people find us, boost us in the ratings, and you'll get it direct to your phone.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.